Good morning, Your Honors. Janet Tung from the Federal Defenders of San Diego, here on behalf of Mr. Zitlal Popoca.
I've seen you before, haven't I?
Yes, Your Honor. I've appeared before you a number of times.
I don't know who this guy is. Smiles all the time. Okay. All right.
Your Honors, this is a textbook case of prosecutorial overcharging. There's no question that there was prostitution here, and there's no question there was importation of prostitutes. But Mr. Zitlal Popoca is not guilty of forcible sex trafficking, as that's defined under Section 1591. To be guilty and properly convicted under Section 1591, one has to employ actual or threatened force, fraud, or coercion, and those means have to be what actually causes the woman to engage in prostitution.
You know, I'm sympathetic to your argument, and when I first saw this case, and I've not had one of these cases in quite this form before. I've seen the ones where it's much more obvious. It's, you know, the slave trafficking and so on, the sort of case we're about to see, the white slave stuff. Well, this guy's an ordinary pimp. Does 1591 reach ordinary pimps?
And where there's no force, fraud, or coercion, like here, no, Your Honor.
Well, an ordinary pimp is, in some, you know, psychological coercion and so on. Most pimp stories, maybe all pimp stories, involve some form of coercion, some sort of abuse and so on. And I'm trying to figure out, is 1591 just a pimp statute?
No, Your Honor. There's a number of statutes that cover pimp-type behavior, and some of which he's convicted under. Section 8 U.S.C. 1328, importation of prostitutes, he's convicted of that. There's Section 2422, he's convicted, you know, correctly as to one of the women, but not as to the other. Section 2421 covers transportation of prostitutes. But let me just address, Judge Fletcher, your question about whether this covers ordinary pimp statutes. The answer is ordinary pimp behavior. The answer is no, and Congress has told us that in the legislative history of Section 1591. They told us that this sex trafficking by force, fraud, or coercion is a level higher, and it's so serious we're going to impose a 15-year mandatory minimum sentence on it.
Does that mean that our decision in Todd is wrong?
Because the
behavior in Todd, he wasn't a very nice pimp, but he was a pimp.
One way in which I think what Your Honor said that Mr. Zitlal Popoca is like an ordinary pimp, and I only partly agree with you. I don't think that's actually true because he's not comparable to somebody like Todd. What we're used to seeing in the United States is, particularly in inner city areas such as where Todd is from, is pimp behavior has become this sort of affair where there's an elaborate set of prostitution rules, and they enforce through. This is a known set of rules. The prostitutes all know what the rules are, and the pimps all know what the rules are, and they enforce through violence. You can see that in Todd. You can see that there's a case out of the 11th Circuit called United States versus Pipkin. It's from 2004, where they get even further into the details of ordinary pimp behavior. They have videos that show how you're supposed to behave, and the biggest difference between this case and United States versus Todd.
Want to speak into the microphone?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
All right.
The biggest difference between this case and United States versus Todd is that Todd had this elaborate set of pimp rules that is typical of this type of forcible behavior, forcible and coercive behavior. And every time the women deviated in Todd from his set of rules, he would beat them violently. And they knew that that was why they were being punished. They were punished for not abiding by his rules. He had control over them, over their money, and they had no autonomy. In this case, these are the biggest places where Mr. Zitlal Popoca doesn't have a set of pimp rules. These women have autonomy. They have become prostitutes over the course of years before this alleged offense occurs in the United States. And over the course of those years, they have developed their own autonomy. Each woman has had long periods, months and years, for both women, where they were living on their own, working as prostitutes without any or much involvement from Mr. Zitlal Popoca. They went out and got their own clients. They went out and made arrangements on how to be paid. They went and did their work. They got the money, they were paid, and they decided what to do with the money. They decided how much to spend on their own needs, clothes, makeup, how much to send home to their families, and how much to send back home to him.
I know you know this language, but let me just read it to you, which is why I'm having... This is actually a difficult case for me, because I'm trying to figure out, is it just any ordinary pimp? The term serious harm means any harm, whether physical or non-physical, including psychological, financial, or reputational harm, sufficiently serious under all the surrounding circumstances to compel a reasonable person of the same background, same circumstances, to perform or continue performing commercial sexual activity in order to avoid incurring that harm. So psychological harm, if someone is psychologically dependent, I mean, if we're talking Stockholm syndrome, at some point you don't need to beat them anymore. They're just there. What kind of psychological stuff are we talking about? Because I can see that what your client is accused of doing could fit within this definition.
That's where I disagree with you, Your Honor. I think if there were a case of Stockholm syndrome, for example, the statute may cover that. But the difference between a case like that and a case like this is,
Stockholm syndrome is identifying with the captor, even loving the captor, and so on. A Stockholm syndrome, there doesn't need to be any beating at all.
But Your Honor, there was no evidence of anything of that effect at all. There was no expert testimony that any sort of coercive atmosphere had been created. In fact, the government attorney at trial, they had an expert lined up. They gave expert notice. They had that person ready to testify, and then they elected not to use that expert. They didn't have the evidence that we're talking about right now was not presented at all at trial. We don't know what that expert was going to say. We don't know if they, in fact, the evidence would not have held up. Now, the other thing that makes this case, very much different is, or I'm sorry, the other point I'd like to make about that definition of serious harm is that
these women basically become slaves.
No, Your Honor.
Yeah.
I disagree.
Yeah.
Your Honor, the women have testified that they fell in love with Mr. Zitlal Popoca and that they continued working as prostitutes because they loved him.
Well, that's part of it.
If the case is going
it's
to be
like,
affirmed...
It's like the battered wife syndrome.
Again, there's no evidence of it. And for Ms. Calixto, he was violent with her. He was violent with her two times in 2005. This case is charged for an offense that begins in 2008. So he was violent with her twice, and then she told him to stop.
I'm getting older, so... you have to speak a little more slowly and project your voice.
Yes, Miss Calixto.
Can we turn the mic up just a little?
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Miss Calixto was absolutely not powerless in this relationship. She told Mr. Zitlal Popoca, "Stop hitting me." In 2005, she said that, and after that point, he never hit her again.
How did they meet?
They met in a bus station. She was in a bus station and she was supposed to meet her boyfriend there, and he didn't show up, and she was at risk of spending the night in the bus station. He said, "Come on."
Yeah, well, she was destitute too, wasn't she?
She was young and she was poor.
She was young and she was poor. Okay, and where was she from?
She was from a farm-working family. I think the Papantla is the name of the town that she was from.
Where?
I think it's coastal Mexico. I might be wrong. But
where?
I think it might be coastal Mexico, but I might be wrong about that. It's.
Yeah. All right, so there she was. How old was she?
She was 17 at the time they met. At the time this offense is charged in 2008, she was in her early 20s. And she had been working as a prostitute and making quite a bit of money as a prostitute for 3 years before this offense was charged.
Who got her into that business?
Mr. Zitlal Popoca introduced her into this business.
Yeah.
Now, if the theory, and this is the theory that the government went on at trial, which is these women were so susceptible to the attention of, they're so dependent and so helpless in the face of being in love with a man that they are slaves to the heart. And that effectively, I mean, that is what the government's theory was at trial, and that is what Section 1591, I refuse to believe that Congress looked at women and felt that they were so helpless and so dependent that simply saying, if you love me, you will do it, is enough to amount to forcible sex trafficking.
What does the definition say?
The definition of forcible sex trafficking, Judge Fletcher read part of it, force, fraud, or coercion.
What?
It's force, fraud, or coercion. And coercion means it's a serious harm, a threat of a serious harm, which includes a psychological harm. But the portion of that definition, I think, is crucial.
Read the rest of the definition.
Of serious harm?
Huh?
Of which part?
I don't have it in front of me right now.
The serious harm portion? The term serious harm means any harm, whether physical or non-physical, including psychological, financial, or reputational harm, that is sufficiently serious under all the surrounding circumstances to compel a reasonable person of the same background and in the same circumstances to perform or to continue performing commercial sexual activity in order to avoid incurring that harm. And that's actually exactly my point, is that second half of the definition of serious harm imports an objectivity standard to this test. So we have to be able to look at women. If we want to go a step further, we can say we can look at Mexican women and say, is a woman who has fallen in love with a man and maintain a relationship with this man, has she gotten to the point where she is compelled? In other words, her activity is involuntary because she's so in love with him. Has she become this slave to her heart that heartbreak will compel her against her will to perform these sex acts? And it's my view that the answer to that is no, that Congress couldn't possibly have meant to look at women and say, women can't act volitionally after they have fallen in love with a man, even if it happens when they're 17, or in the case of Ms. De La Cruz, she was 19 and in college when she met Mr. Zillow.
This is when they're young, they're destitute, they have no one around, huh? And these guys are out there preying on them, they're nice to them, huh? They take care of them, then they start dominating them and beating them up, huh? And pushing them into prostitution, huh? And they still have nowhere to go. They suffer a lot of humiliation, but on the other hand, the pimps are nice to them at times. They get them nice clothes and all the rest of it. So that's just part of this syndrome. They become their slaves, and the slaves, you know no other life than the kindness of the pimps. That's the way it works. And, you know, we've got a serious problem with this. It's going on all over the world today.
Your Honor, it's
all over the world.
It is not a good thing.
We're bringing in women into this country from other places.
It's not a good thing. In the case of Ms. Calixto, there's a completely different relationship. And Ms. De La Cruz, there's a different relationship than what Your Honor just described. Ms. Calixto was living in Mexico prior to the charged period. She was living in Mexico for months, not working as a prostitute. And she was in telephone contact with Mr. Zitlal Popoca. And he told her, I want you to stop working and stay not working. And she called him and said, I want to come to the United States. And he said, no, I don't want you to come. I want you to stay here and not work. And she kept persisting with him. And she knew what she was getting into, and that's what she did. She called and called and called him until he said, okay, I will help you make the financial arrangements to come, or the smuggling arrangements to come to the United States. And that's not somebody who's enslaved. She was more or less I'm not going to say equal footing, but she was not powerless, and this was a real relationship these two people had. With Ms. De La Cruz, she was not a slave. She knew that she could leave him, and she, in fact, did leave him. She left him three times and came back. She left him in Mexico twice, and actually in the United States. She went to the trolley station. She went there without telling him, and then she gets to the trolley station, and she realizes, you know, she borrowed somebody else's telephone and called him and said, Adrian, can you come bring me my cell phone? I forgot to bring my cell phone.
I dropped my handkerchief.
Right.
Meaning, I dropped my handkerchief, so maybe you'd come and get me.
Right, right. And then he came, and when he came, he wasn't threatening her with force or physical restraints or anything like that. He came and he said, here's your cell phone. I'd like you to get in the car. She said no. And he drove off. And then there's yet another telephone conversation where he says, I'm going to come by, and if you want to come, get in my car. And if you don't, you may leave. Both women knew that they could leave.
Can I ask a question here? The definition of serious harm. I'm open to the possibility that there was psychological harm here, but it has to be more than just psychological harm. It has to be psychological harm that's so serious to compel, right? Isn't that the strongest part of your argument, that even if there is psychological harm, didn't compel these women to engage in the prostitution?
That's exactly right, Judge Bennett. It has to compel these women to do it. And Congress has given us just a little more insight about what that compelling meant. In the course of passing 1591, they said this is so serious that trafficking contains all the elements of forcible rape, as we understand it.
And the evidence of compulsion here, or the compel part, is virtually non-existent.
It's very non-existent. Thin. It's non-existent, I agree. In all the testimony that comes out, the women say, I did this because I was in love with him and I wanted him to stay and not leave. And I think one of the most telling pieces of testimony is Ms. Calixto is asked about, the women have an interaction with a rescue type organization after they're arrested. And she's asked on the stand about her interaction with this rescue organization called BSCC. And she says, you told the people at the BSCC you weren't forced to be a prostitute. And, she's agreeing to what she says. Then they asked you, why were you here? And what she said in response was, I don't know. I wasn't forced to be a prostitute.
But if she did it out of love, and love can be considered maybe psychological, if she was compelled to do it out of her love, does that qualify? It seems bizarre that it would qualify as serious harm, but we have to go with the definition in the statutory scheme.
I think that's a great point. Love is certainly psychological, but as Your Honor said, it doesn't. I mean, as the point you made is, it has to compel the woman to act in this particular way, not just this woman, but a reasonable woman acting in their circumstances. It's just got to be so much that a woman would feel like it was, she's powerless.
So doesn't this get back to Judge Fletcher's opening question about, isn't this just ordinary pimping activity?
It's certainly no more than ordinary pimping activity. It's not force, fraud, or coercion. And the point, one more point that I'd like to make about this, love as coercion.
But what about was there any inducement here? Any temptation, arousing hope, or desire, all of those fall within that dictionary definition of persuade. And this is the Allenstein case.
Do you mean, is this on the second argument, the section 24?
No, it's U.S. versus Roshkovsky.
Okay, and Your Honor, this is concerning the second argument that there was no...
Who persuaded whom?
Right, exactly. Yeah, I think that's right. The government says that Mr. Zitlal Popoka persuaded her to come to the United States, but the evidence shows the opposite. The evidence is, it's undisputed. She called and said, may I come? He says, no. May I come? No. May I come? No. May I come? Yes. And for us to consider that to be persuasion, inducement, enticement, or coercion, that's completely counter to sort of any definition I can think of those words. In order to be the guilty party who's persuading, enticing, inducing, or coercing, prior to the interaction you have with the other person, you have to formulate that desire in your head. That's what Roshkovsky says. It says, as long as the defendant has that desire in his head, it doesn't matter that the other person also has the desire in the head. He's still producing, enticing, or, coercing or whatever the other term is. And in this case, Mr. Zitlal Popoka is the opposite. He has the opposite desire. He does not want Ms. Calixto to come. And, the way I thought about it was, I have a 3-year-old, and my 3-year-old daughter said to me, Mom, I'd like to go to the zoo. No, I don't want to go to the zoo. Yes, zoo. No, zoo. I don't want to take her to the zoo. Finally, she wears me down, and I say, okay, fine, I'll take you to the zoo, and since you're three, I'll drive the car and I'll pay for your admission to the zoo. In no sense of those words have I persuaded, enticed, induced, or coerced her to go to the zoo. I didn't want to go. It was reluctant.
Well, there was some competition, wasn't there, between the two women?
I think that could be inferred, that after they arrived in the United States, there was competition between them.
That's probably why he said he didn't want her to come.
Right.
Yeah. But didn't your daughter coerce you?
She's too young to be tried.
Or she's a master psychologist.
All right, we'll hear from the government.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Mark Rahe for the United States. Your Honor, the government's position in this case is that to be liable under 1591, it doesn't have to be an all-or-nothing proposition. My opponent made a lot of hay about the fact that maybe at certain times of their association with the defendant, these victims testified that they had feelings for him. One at one point said, "You didn't have to put a gun to my head." But I'm not aware of any interpretation of the law that says at all times do the victims have to feel a certain way. And in fact, the only precedential authority out of this circuit in this field covering this statute, Todd, had victims with much the same kind of story. There were three victims in that case. All three of them started out consensually committing acts of prostitution for the defendant in that case.
But they did get beaten, right?
At some point they did. But they weren't beaten all the time. I admit that's an easier case. If we had had something like that here.
You know, if you're right, if this is what 1591 means, get ready. You're going to be the local vice squad. I mean, every pimp in Los Angeles can be prosecuted under this theory.
Well, Your Honor, I understand.
Go for it. I mean, the federal government has done that enough to do.
Right. Well, obviously, I think when this statute was enacted 10 years ago, I mean, if your concerns are true, then that should go to the legislature. All we're here is to enforce the law as it's written. This is a statute. Congress was concerned.
In your brief, you wrote it as if the behavior prior to coming to the United States was relevant to the determination as to whether or not there was force, fraud, or coercion.
Absolutely.
Why is that so when the statute says will be used rather than has been used, and the indictment period coincides with the arrival in the United States?
This is my understanding, Your Honor. It does say will be used, but this is a backward-looking exercise. This is a most unusual.
Will be is not backward. Will be is what will happen in the future. And the beginning date of the charge is when these two women come into the United States. So why are you looking as to what happened before they came into the United States?
Because it's relevant to the issue of coercion.
In what way? Okay.
The statute defines coercion broadly. We've already talked about serious harm. It uses the phrase any scheme, plan, or pattern.
Right.
With all due respect, Your Honor, these cases, a lot of them, what if somebody in Ukraine says, you know what, unless you go to America, I'll kill everybody in your family in this village. And then that person gets to America, commits acts of prostitution. There will be some instances that force, fraud, or coercion was initiated prior to the charging date, but there's no question that it then caused the sex act within the dates charged in the offense.
I got that. So I think you and I then may be on the same page. It's possible that we have to look back to the behavior in Mexico in order to understand the coercion that takes place after they get to the United States. But the coercion has to take place in the United States.
Right. Well, we agree that it's continuing. It doesn't just...
No, I don't say that it's continuing. I do not agree with that. I think the coercion has to take place after they come to the United States, and in order to understand what is coercive, it may well be relevant what happened before.
Right.
But the coercion has to happen after they come to the United States.
Exactly. And you know what? Look, I know I'm not saying Todd was wrongly decided. I'm not trying to create any law, any conflict with that. What we're saying is coercion is defined as a pattern. This defendant is not just an ordinary pimp. He has a systematic means that he duplicated with both of these.
Particularly gentle pimp, as a matter of fact.
I disagree. And I'll get to that in a second. It's great. You only hear half the story whenever you read the defense brief about, oh, how much they loved him.
Well, you know, I read your brief, too.
I appreciate it. Well, then, Ian, I'm here to make my case. Excerpt of Record 166, they asked Ms. De La Cruz, was the defendant ever angry with you? Yes. Was that frequently or very frequently? Very frequently. Just 2 months into that relationship, in September of 2006, he beats her up because she finds condoms in her wallet, in his wallet. At excerpt of record 164, she testifies that she decided to never challenge him again because she was very scared of him. And she described that as a turning point in their relationship. Between July 2006 and January 2007, she once tried to keep the money. My opponent makes it sound like these women are independent contractors just choosing this as a profession. She decides to keep the money. The defendant gets angry.
And what's the nature of the relationship after they come to the United States?
I would say it's the same as it was before. And if what it was before amounts to coercion, then what it was after is also coercion.
Now, is there any beating once they get to the United States?
There's no evidence of that in the record.
And is there any evidence that he is resisting them leaving once they get to the United States?
I don't know if there's per se evidence of that. There's that one story about her forgetting the cell phone, and then as soon as she comes in the truck, oh, I knew you'd never leave me again, I love you. And something this great from the man who's beaten her three times before, who the record showed in the year leading up to when she came to the United States, hit her several times, one time with the cable, one time with the broomstick. Right before they came to the United States, the defendant told Ms. De La Cruz, a friend of mine who's a pimp's looking for a woman who called the police on him because they want to beat her or kill her. Ms. De La Cruz testified that she would never call the police on the defendant because of that. I know this is tough. This statute has a temporal scope. The reason I brought all that up in the brief is to say this is the scheme, plan, or pattern. This defendant is so good, he can set a clock. It's like a grandfather clock that chimes every hour on the hour with the tune. If he builds the machine properly, knows.
I think I've persuaded you, or maybe you persuaded yourself, to make a somewhat different argument than I read in your brief. As I read your brief, you were saying that we simply got to look at what happened in Mexico, and if that was coercion, that was guilt under 1591. I think you're no longer saying that.
Well, that's not my intent. Was what happened in Mexico still has to cause that commercial sex act during the time charge in the
indictment. Oh, you see, well, then you and I are in a disagreement. I think the coercion has to be after they come into the United States. Don't you? That's what will be used means, right?
If this record shows in Mexico for 2 years, I find these young women when they're 17 or 18, I send them to my family's home, I tell them don't talk to anybody, don't use the phone, I go away, I leave them alone.
He met her. He wanted to marry her.
Yeah, exactly. Within 24 hours, introducing both of these women as his wife and then leaving them alone.
But isn't that extraterritorial application of the statute? I mean, I think the stuff in Mexico is relevant and admissible on whether there is serious harm in the United States. But the jury, I'm going to throw this out there, but it doesn't seem to me that they were properly instructed on the dates, and you had that discussion with the trial court judge, and I think the defense wanted to change the instructions, and he said, hey, this case has been around here too long, we can't change the instructions now, and so you threw in the indictment and they got the date of the indictments, but the jury was never instructed on how they could consider the Mexican evidence, and they could have convicted the defendant in this case based solely on the Mexican evidence and found that to be the coercion, and that's really troubling.
Well, I would disagree, Your Honor.
Why don't you take each one of these victims separately?
Absolutely. As with Ms. De La Cruz, they meet in March 2006, takes her to his family home, isolates her, says, if you love me, you'll commit acts of prostitution for me. After a month of that isolation, she gives in. September 2006, just a few months into the relationship, he beats her.
You're talking about
Ms. De La Cruz.
Talking about Annabelle.
Correct. And then there's always a cause and effect to these things. It's the first act of violence. She testifies she immediately is scared of him, doesn't ever want to confront him again. Then she tries to keep the money. He gets mad. I know Judge Fletcher asked at one point, oh, didn't the defendant let them go? At one point, the defendant toys with it. Ms. De La Cruz says, you know what, if you want to go, go ahead. Just meet me on a flight, maybe it was Mexico City. He's waiting for her at the airport. I lied to you.
Yeah, this is still in Mexico, right?
Correct.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
This is going forward. And then act of violence, too. In January of 2007, she simply talks to another woman at a party. He gets upset, beats her at the party.
Why don't you enunciate each word and speak slower?
I apologize, Your Honor. I'm getting kind of amped up here. But January of 2007, it's the second act of violence. It hasn't even been 1 year since they first met. And then a third act of violence occurs around the same time. She throws corn on the cob out the car window. He makes her go back and pick it up with her mouth. Acts of humiliation designed to create a scheme, plan, or pattern of coercion. April 2007 to March 2008, the exact year right before Ms. De La Cruz comes to America, excerpt of record 171, the defendant continued to hit her several times. Sometimes he used a cable, sometimes he used a broomstick. And at the same time, the defendant told Ms. De La Cruz a story about a pimp friend of hers who was looking for one of his prostitutes who called the police on him in order to beat her or kill her. And then they come to America. Can we just forget all of this? What this defendant has done is he's created his plan, scheme, or coercion that he knows will continue to pay dividends in the United States. And the other thing is, with as to Ms. De La Cruz, there is perhaps a simpler way to get around this. Financial harm. As Judge Bennett pointed out, the statutory definition of serious harm, Congress has said physical or non-physical, psychological includes financial. Adrian paid her passage across, and Ms. Calixto testified that was at least $14, or over $1,000. Here's a woman who has no papers to be in the United States, is told she has to pay back the smuggling fee. She can't go get an honest job. She continues, I think
he has to pay back what he paid the party that transported
the smuggler, exactly.
Both of them over here.
Correct.
Yeah. And he said he got the money from some relative.
Correct.
And he's got to pay the relative back. Right. So she's obligated to go out and work as a prostitute and make the money so he can pay back
exactly
the coyote that brought him across.
And what I stand before you to say now is to remind, what's our posture here, sufficiency review, where we review the evidence in the light most favorable. It may be a close case, it may not. But I think a jury was within its rights to infer, even putting aside all the violence that happened, if you want to say that only happened in Mexico, here's the financial harm.
I'm not making it up. I'm just trying to figure out what happened. The violence took place only in Mexico.
Yeah.
So what do you mean, if
exactly.
I want to say that?
But the, and the reason I fight that in the brief is because then it's not like they come to America and Adrian says, oh, hey, I'm going to go serve. You guys can do what you want to do.
No, I got that point. I understand. That's the deal, and I'm actually
your argument is that when he said to her, you got to go out and make this $5,000 so I can pay it back, so he put pressure on her then.
Exactly. And I know
that's the coercion.
As defined in the statute, which says includes financial harm.
Yeah.
Can I get to a point on restitution? Who decided how much to award on restitution? Was it the judge or was it the jury?
The judge.
The judge. Given that the statute says will be used and it really applies prospectively from the date of entry to the United States, which is how can you justify restitution for the period in Mexico?
Well, Your Honor, again, I think because it has that disgorgement proviso. The way the
59... It's disgorgement during the period of the offense.
Well, actually, the statute doesn't limit it to the temporal time. What the statute, 1593, says, the victim's losses include the same definition as is in 2259b3, and that says losses proximately caused by the offense.
The offense, okay, that's the offense that's being prosecuted.
And this is 1593 says that's... The term losses to the victims includes that and shall, in addition, include wrongful sums, the value of the victim's labor. Our argument is...
During the period of the offense.
Well, it doesn't go on to say that. And, in fact, in 2259...
So you're saying benefit to him, you can get money for a period long preceding the period of the offense? Is that what your argument is as to why the rest of the...
I mean, I think it has to be because that's what happened, Your Honor. Yeah.
No, I'm asking you not... to say what happened. I'm asking you to define what's available for restitution in the sense of benefit to the defendant. You're saying benefit to the defendant can be a period preceding the offense.
But I don't mean it's a benefit to the defendant. The way the TVPA defines restitution in 1593 It includes not only the losses proximately caused by the offense, but shall in addition include unjust enrichment.
I know, but I'm asking you, and you're saying the unjust enrichment includes unjust enrichment in a period prior to the offense.
Correct, Your Honor. And the reason I say that, even if
where's that coming from?
Well, for one thing, it's coming from the absence of a temporal caveat, which is set forth to 2259b3.
What was the point of going into all that for?
Into going into what, Your Honor?
Why were you looking for reparations?
Well,
did he have any money?
The restitution comes forward.
Yeah, did he have any money?
I believe he does from all these years of pimping.
Well, how do you know that?
Look, this issue was litigated below, Your Honor. The defense has no qualms with the calculation of the restitution. It's only about the scope. I wasn't the trial lawyer. I reviewed the record. This defendant said, I'm not going to invoke my Fifth Amendment rights when I talk to my probation officer and talk about all the money I had. So I think the ship may be sailed on that argument, but as I stand here, I don't have any ledgers. He didn't file any tax returns.
The reason I raise this is not just with respect to the definition of period during which restitution is appropriate, but it's because it seems to me this whole case has confused the period of the offense. And I wish we had had an appeal of the jury instruction, which we don't. But it strikes me as very likely that the jury thought that the coercion that took place in Mexico was relevant in and of itself, not just relevant in terms of figuring out the psychological state after the arrival in the United States. That's my concern about where I think this case might have gone wrong. But I'm having trouble getting there because there was no objection that I can see as cognizable in the district court of the jury instruction, and there's no appeal to us on the jury instruction.
That's correct, Your Honor. And when all this evidence came out at trial about all the things that happened in Mexico, the very experienced counsel on the other side, was there ever one objection for relevance to all of that testimony? No. So the government's position, I know I won't repeat it, you know, oh, but if I'll submit, obviously, there was the one question about Raskowski that the count, too, about the enticement, if I might.
I think you guys are just wrong as to Calixto. I mean, she was not persuaded to come. She persuaded him to allow her to come.
I just want to read one quote from Raskowski itself.
I was on the panel. I know the case.
Yeah.
I'm aware of that, too. Well, then I'll see. What are the acts the 2422 hits? It doesn't just hit inducement. Enticement's in there. Well, what Raskowski says that
On Annabelle, the coercion was to repay the costs of transportation. That was enough to allege coercion for involuntary servitude.
That's one of our theories, yes.
What?
That's one of our theories, yes.
Okay, so you got that. And that's the Musri case, right?
Correct.
Okay. Now, what about Florenza? I think you got a weak case there.
I won't deny that, Your Honor, that it's weaker when compared to Annabelle.
What?
It's weaker when compared to Annabelle. But my position is it's still sufficient under the deferential review that governs on sufficiency of the evidence challenges.
Well, tell us what the evidence was on that. Now, you went through Annabelle. Now, let's go through Florencia.
Correct. They met a few years earlier in 2004, and the same thing happened. He finds her in an isolated, vulnerable position, goes on a drive, professes...
Where was she from?
I don't recall the exact village, Your Honor. But she was at a bus station in Oaxaca. She was there visiting a fair where she thought she was going to meet her boyfriend. And then out of nowhere comes our defendant.
Was what, that Annabelle?
No, Annabelle was the college student that he met at a park.
Okay, all right.
Ms. Calixto was at a bus station in Oaxaca,
yeah,
left by her boyfriend, and along comes our defendant. They drive away. Within a few hours, he's suddenly saying, again, this story, you want to be my wife? By the end of the day, he's taken her almost to the same place that he later takes Ms. De La Cruz, then leaves her there in his family's house. Don't talk to anybody. She starts getting lonely, and she's wondering what's going on.
All right.
Then the first act of violence doesn't happen there long thereafter. She went looking for him. This is an excerpt of Record 67 to 70. Found the defendant at home with another woman. He got mad. He hit. He punched her. He dragged her down the stairs by her hair and threw her up against a table that had apparently a protruding nail. The second and third acts of violence, the second one, this is excerpt of Record 116 to 117. She was upset that he wasn't spending enough time with her. She had one of her Johns call him. He got mad, whipped her with the cord of an iron. And then at the same around, not long thereafter, she said something he didn't like. He went to hit her. She threatened to call the cops, and she stopped, or he stopped. This is excerpt of record 118. And then thereafter, I think the record shows, my opponent made it sound like, boy, she makes all the money in the world and she can decide what she wants to do with it. I think the testimony showed she still had to give that all to Adrian. She was under his...
How about coercion in the United States?
Well, the theory, there's nothing more beyond what I just told you, Your Honor. But our theory is that when he sets up this pattern, that's his plan, scheme, or pattern, he doesn't deviate from that, and then she ends up prostituting within 3 or 4 days of arriving in the United States.
How about the narrower question of persuading to come to the United States? Because you've got a conviction that he persuaded her to come to the United States, when it seems to me the evidence is, exactly as was just described, she calls him, he resists, she persists, and he finally says yes. I think she persuaded rather than he persuaded.
A couple points here.
He disputes that he was requiring her to repay the transportation costs.
Right. This is my answer to this, Your Honor.
Well, he said, yeah. Isn't that right? She denied that he told her that she had engaged in prostitution here to repay the travel costs.
For Florence, yes. She denied that.
She denied it.
Right.
Okay. So you got a weaker case.
Yeah, and I won't deny that, Your Honor, between the two of them. There's a few points there. First of all, to go back to the rap.
So why don't you just pick up the chips you have that are any good and not worry about the rest of it?
If that's how it ends up, Your Honor, I have no problem with that. But that's my mandate. My mandate is to come here and try.
Can you see how it's going to end up?
I got an argument. I was asked a question several questions back. I just want at least...
It's a pretty bad argument.
Well, yeah. Everybody can laugh. That's great. But then at some point, I would love to get a chance to answer the question. Thank you.
Why don't you do that, and then I've got a couple more for you.
I figure some more are coming. All right. 2422, it has various acts in the disjunctive, induce, entice. One of them is enticement. When you look at Rashkovsky, I'm reading a quote from page 1137 of that opinion. None of the statutory language requires Rashkovsky to have created out of whole cloth the woman's desire to go to the United States. It merely, uses the word merely, requires that he have convinced or influenced the victims to actually undergo the journey or made the possibility more appealing. Thus, it is not significant that Tulasheva, the victims in that case, had pre-existing wishes to go to Russia or to leave Russia for the United States, especially considering that they never acted upon those desires until he made it attainable.
Right.
I get it that this may be a weak case for a 2422 as to Florence, but all I'm saying is I read this as the law. Did our defendant make it more appealing for her to go? She never indicated that she could pay her own way over here.
But what happened in the case, the language you're just reading from, the defendant traveled to Russia to say, would you please come? Now, they wanted to come, but they traveled to Russia to say, listen, we can make it possible, we're coming. They initiated. Here we've got her calling, saying, can I come? And he says, no.
And then he eventually agrees to pay, Your Honor.
Well,
I don't know if that's a dispute.
Yeah, sure, it sounds attractive. He eventually agrees to pay, but then on what condition? That you pay me back out of your prostitution earnings? That doesn't sound like much of a deal.
No, but all I'm saying is all he has to do is make the possibility more appealing.
I got the argument.
And one other thing, too. Is,
I got the argument.
I was just going to say with Florence, I think there's...
Then the guy involved in that case, his name was Rashkovsky.
Counsel, on the 1591 convictions on the force, fraud, and coercion element,
right.
Reading your brief, with all due respect, was like playing the old shell game with where's the P? And the P is force, fraud, and coercion. And you mouth that phrase a zillion times in the brief, but you never really come out and say what the force, fraud, and coercion is. Is it financial? Is it psychological? Is it physical restraint? Because you have a whole section of your brief arguing about how coercion is broader than a serious harm, but that only applies when physical restraint is used, and you never even allege that. So I'm totally baffled by what your actual theory is as to where the fraud of force and coercion in the United States was. I understand your argument about Mexico, but where in the United States was there force, fraud, or coercion, and which was it, or is it a combination of it? You never really say it in your brief, do you?
I thought I did, and obviously disappoints me to hear that. I'm sorry. One of the reasons I had to, my opponent made a lot of assumptions from the get-go that I felt had to be dealt with.
Well, turn to page 23 of your brief, and you tell me what that whole discussion does about on the bottom part of the page. However, the statutory definition of coercion is broader. What does that have to do with this case?
Because it seemed to me that one of the premises of my opponent was that everything had to be judged from a reasonable victim's point of view. The reason I pointed that out is because the definition of serious harm, it includes half of its components have that reasonable person compulsion, half don't.
Yeah, but the other half don't apply to this case, so it's got nothing to do with anything in this case.
Well, respectfully,
with regards to physical, it only applies, it's only broader with regard to physical restraint. You haven't alleged physical restraint in this case, so it's got nothing to do with this
case. I thought it was part of the evidence. One of the arguments that the prosecutor made below was, look, you have this evidence, these acts of violence. They're worried if they disregard this defendant even
most. You know, you're so damn stubborn.
I thought I'm just trying to answer
this. I thought we had come to an agreement that the period of offense is in the United States, and there was no physical restraint in the United States.
Is it correct?
So?
And no evidence of it.
But there needs to be a fear of it. If he has a plan, you know, what Todd says is the defendant has to know a modus, established modus operandi will yield results for him in the future. So I'm not trying to play games here. This is, you know, even Todd itself said this is one of the most awkwardly written federal statutes. And there's, you know, how will we know when it says will be used? Nobody can know knowledge of the future to an exact certainty. But again, but Judge Bender, I want to come back to that. I thought I laid out with the different victims, like one of the arguments was the financial harm. I mean, I thought I separated that out with the, you know, that's at page 34. I gave, enumerated the different ways that somebody could find, as to Ms. De La Cruz, that at least this coercion was part of the motivation. Excerpt of record, you know, 214, and then I also talk about this financial harm. But, I mean, I'm sorry if I could have done a better job, and I apologize for that.
No, that's not an easy case. But you do have coercion on the, what they're talking about, reimburse. $5,000 because it falls within the one of our cases. Okay.
Unless you have any more questions, I will. Thank you.
All right.
Your Honors, I just have two quick points to make. And one is to address Judge Parkerson's, your interest in the financial harm. The government's argument is that there's financial harm because Mr. Zitlalpopoca, or threat of financial harm because Mr. Zitlalpopoca said, you need to pay back this smuggling fee. That may be a financial matter, but it's not a threat of financial harm. A threat of financial harm is something where you threaten to injure somebody's finances. I will empty your bank account. But this is just, I paid this money, you need to pay me back. If I say to my 3-year-old daughter, I took you to the zoo, you need to pay me back, that's a financial matter. It's not a threat of financial harm to her. I haven't said it.
Let me ask you this question. This is on the jury instruction. It does seem to me that the jury might have been misled in terms of what it could count in terms of the period of the offense and when the coercion had to take place. Did you make an objection to the jury instruction at the trial? Were you the trial attorney?
I was not, Your Honor.
There was an objection made at trial to the jury instruction.
There was an objection generally that I think Judge Bennett mentioned to the instruction and the nature of the instruction, but my recollection is as to the specific dates, there was not a specific objection to
And did you, in your appeal, in your written appeal to us, say that there was something wrong with the jury instructions such that the jury didn't understand what they were supposed to decide?
That's not one of the arguments in the appeal.
Would you like to make one now?
I think that it is true, looking back on what happened, that there was the jury appeared to be confused about what time period that they were looking at. I think that is.
And I think defense counsel did point that out to the district court judge. But the district court judge, understandably so, I mean, I've been there. You don't want to go back and, you know, amend the instructions at the 11th hour. But that would have been preferable to the mess that we inherited.
Right.
Because the defense counsel did say, well, we've got a problem with these dates and what happened, the scope of the indictment. And then the solution was to just send the indictment back, I believe.
Right.
Without
right.
any guidance as to what the effect of that would be and what the effect of the dates were.
That's right, Your Honor. And the arguments were made in the defense's closing argument that during this period there was no forced fraud or coercion. That has been consistently maintained throughout the defense in this case.
Let me ask you again. Would you like to make an argument now on appeal that there was an improper jury instruction given such that the jury did not understand properly the period of the offense and what should be considered and in what fashion?
I would be happy to make that argument now, Your Honor.
Okay.
And if
and you might object to it being made now, I understand.
And if I may just make one final point, and it would be that what's interesting to me is that the government's trial theory below is, as we've discussed quite a bit, is that this love is what made them do it. And that is what they argued below. That is the only thing they argued below. They say the prosecutor in closing says he actually gives up this violence theory. We see four new theories that the government has come up with on appeal. They actually take the government's trial theory, the prosecutor's theory below, and drop it like a hot potato. And now there's four new theories. But the prosecutor at closing argument actually said to the jury, you can motivate someone to move or act if you threaten them with violence, but if that's how you do it, it's probably not going to last more than once. If you convince them with love, you can convince them to do just about anything, and that's what he did here. They've conceded that this is their theory, and now they've dropped it again. And that's the point that I'd like to make. We're now looking at five theories. I think if this case were a play, you would call it three characters in search of a theory of liability. And I think that's a pretty important consideration. Let me
ask you this. When Annabelle was told that she'd have to go to work and raise that $5,000 so that, you know, she could pay back the person who loaned him the money that he used to pay the person who brought him across. You know what I'm talking about?
She was told that she had to pay back the money.
Huh?
Yes, she was told she would have to
pay the money. Now, in the past, when she was told that she had to go out to work and she had to raise certain sums of money for him, and if she failed, what would happen to her?
She was not told that she had to raise certain sums of money, and she didn't have consequences because she was not told that she had to raise. The women in Todd, the victims in Todd, were told they had to work a certain number of hours and raise a certain amount of money. And in Todd, there's actual evidence that I think it was $900 a day or something like that. In that case, the defendant beat the women when they didn't raise the right amount of money. And here, we don't have that.
Didn't he tell her that it cost $5,000 and he expected her to raise it, or words to that effect?
I think it was something closer to $1,500, and he said, you need to pay me back.
That's what he said to her.
That's not the exact words, but yeah. It was something to the effect of, you need to pay me back.
So she knew, or had to know from past experience, that if she did not obey him, that there'd be consequences.
Once again, there were instances of violence between Mr. Zitlalpopoca and Ms. De La Cruz, and they did not concern prostitution. Not one instance concerned prostitution. Every instance happened, again, in Mexico, not in the United States.
All right. You're going to make your jury instruction argument?
Well, I would make the argument as Judge Fletcher, I mean, as Judge Fletcher proposed it.
So is plain error like jurisdiction that can be raised at any time?
If I haven't done something that I should have done, it's on behalf of my client, it's on me.
I have to say flatly, what troubles me about this case is that it's a close question to me as to whether or not there's coercion within the meaning of the statute after the arrival in the United States, and I'm not concerned, and I am concerned that the jury didn't understand precisely the question in front of them. And I think the evidence could go either way, frankly, in front of a jury, but I don't think they understood that that was the question.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.